Hello and welcome to another episode of Midwest Magic. I am your host, Ethan Richardson, with my co-host,
Justin Washburn.
And we've decided to make a new addition to the team as a more permanent fixture. We had so much fun with him last week, and we like him as a person. So from now on, we will also be joined by...
Mike Thompson.
Oh, he sounds so excited to be here.
Hey, guys.
All right, so we've got some pretty fucking cool stuff to talk about this week. So we'll start off talking about the Star City Games Invitational. I would talk about the World Cup, but honestly, wasn't that interesting to me anyway. I don't know about you guys. Did you guys watch it at all?
I didn't know it was going on, to be honest.
I watched. So my dumbass decided to wake up at 3 o'clock on Friday morning and watch the first. Whatever it was, 7 rounds. And then when I found out the U.S. wasn't in the running anymore, I just kept, like, I would keep tabs on it, but I didn't actually watch it. The only cool thing that I think came out of that tournament was they do the standard format that they do for the World Magic Cup. It's called Unified Standard, where you can only play four copies of card across all three decks. And a lot of the teams ended up playing a really interesting, I won't call it necessarily good or not, it was kind of back and forth all weekend long, but a really interesting looking Teemer Megamorph deck. I don't want to say it was good, but it was interesting. It was definitely something to look at for the future, though, because the deck had a lot of power in it. It just was awkward at times because of lands and stuff like that. So maybe with an actual complement of the correct 60 cards instead of a weird 60 cards, it might end up being something good.
Yeah, I don't remember who it was, but I saw a couple that were doing, like, a Tarkaren Esper Dragons because there's, like, no overlap whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
And then whatever else they threw together.
Yep, pretty much. And the Teemer Megamorph deck was what a lot of people ended up playing because people were really worried about Green Rail Eldrazi just being the one deck that was busted. And then nobody played it, so...
And Italy won, which is cool, because I think, you know, they're not thought of much in the international Magic community, so good for them. But I was with the U.S. once they were eliminated. Like, I tuned into it at work, and I watched, like, the last 30 seconds of the game that eliminated the U.S.
Yep.
And was like, cool, alright, my entire interest in this event is now banished. No point. So, we'll focus on Star City Games today, and then we're going to talk about some spoilers that happened, like, 2 hours ago. So, could be exciting. Okay, so, for SCG Invitational, happened in Las Vegas, parallel to an Open, which we probably won't talk about much, who cares. The Invitational is what matters. It is like the amateur pro player pro tour, right? That's a good description, right?
For the Invitational? Yeah, It's kind of like a Grinders Pro Tour.
Yeah.
Is what I would label it as.
That's fair. So, okay. The guy who won, Caleb Scherer. Mike, you had some choice words.
Yeah, just want to say I called it. Called the shot. I didn't specifically say he's going to win the Invitational, but last week I said, Caleb Scherer, he's on a tear right now, and he deserves all the props he's getting. Watch out for this dude. And lo and behold,
he wins the entire Invitational.
Within days. Like,
yeah, literally days.
You know, next season, watch out. He's getting... No, it's a couple days later. So, props to Mike. I owe you a drink or something, because that's some pretty clever predictions there. So, he won the whole thing. So we're going to kind of go player by player in the top eight, because, you know, it was a mixed format, standard and modern. Did they play any Legacy in the prelims, or...?
They did not. It was all standard modern. All
right, cool. So Caleb won, he won the whole thing. In modern, he was playing Affinity. Is there anything super special about his Affinity list, or is it pretty straightforward?
Nope.
Seems
pretty standard.
I've never seen Welding Jar ever incorporated, but last week we saw it, and now we're seeing it again.
Yeah,
so it must be really good.
It's pretty standard. It doesn't always get played, but in my opinion, it's a pretty standard card.
Yeah.
Definitely on the list of cards that can come in and out of that deck, depending on what the week looks like.
Yeah, but, I mean...
His sideboard's kind of interesting as some one-ofs. Like, he's playing a one of Nature's Claim, which I don't know if it's, like, especially since he's playing the red... Well, he's not even playing that. He's playing a swamp. Like, there is no mountain in his deck.
That's actually a little odd. I'm assuming that's a typo.
That it might be a typo. But, like, because I'm, like, I'm going through his sideboard. I'm like, but he's playing Blood Moon. Like, what is he? Does he rely off?
He's got Glimmer Void.
Well, yeah, he relies off Glimmer Voids and Springleaf Drums to play a Blood Moon. But,
I am kind of.
And Moxel Pulls.
And the Gear Parather Grid.
He's playing four Thoughtcast main boards, so I want to say that's not a swamp.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet that is not a swamp. They were probably like, he's not playing a mountain. We don't know what to put in there.
He probably won the whole thing with 59 cards. No.
Oh, no. How dare he?
So, yeah, pretty straightforward list. Nothing new there. And then we can switch over to his standard deck, which is Abzan Aggro, and I have a feeling we're going to get a lot of the same.
All right. So Caleb was playing Abzan Aggro, and he was playing the Snapping Gnarled version, which you either play Snapping Gnarled or you play Air of the Wilds. I personally have played Air of the Wilds version, and it's okay. I'm interested in trying Snapping Gnarled just due to the fact that the deck's playing 12 fetches, so it's going to consistently be a 3-3 or a 4-4. So it's going to, and especially when you play Anafenza and put counters on it, it's just going to continue to be bigger. He's also playing two Silkwrap mainboard, which I was always playing Silkwrap in the sideboard, but Silkwrap actually seems pretty good in the mainboard.
Yeah. That's actually a small change, I think, from last week. I believe he was playing, he didn't have Silkwrap, so he was playing three Dromoka's Commands, single Murderous Cut, and then a fourth Den Protector. I could be wrong about that, but I believe that is the case. So, I mean, it's definitely an adjustment to the Logan Mize list that popped up last week. So.
And see, I remember a couple weeks ago posing the question of whether or not Snapping Gnarled and a Landfall combination would be the future of Abzan Aggro. So I can say one-third of the way called it.
Well played. Well played, sir.
Yeah, I'm not going to say 100% called it because I can't exactly remember what I said, and I'm not going to go back and look.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah, all right. So, couple changes, I think, you know, just kind of trying to predict the meta a little bit, but nothing too outrageous, nothing we've never seen before. He is running those four Pitiless Horde in the sideboard.
Yeah, and it's just cards just pretty good, especially against, like, Esper control matchup. Like,
and wait a minute.
Just being able to keep.
Wait a minute. What is this rising Miasma in the sideboard?
Yeah. When I heard them talk about it in the commentary when they were showing it, when he was playing against Jeskai Black, I had to look up that card. I'm like, what the hell does that card do? It's a black and three colorless sorcery. It's an uncommon from Battle for Zendikar. It says all creatures get -2/-2 until end of turn as an Awaken 3 cost for 5 colorless and double black. I don't think you're ever going to play the Awaken cost, but, I mean, against, like, a Tarka Red that's just trying to go wide with, like, Holding Outburst, I think this card seems fine.
Yeah.
Like, are they going to expect this card? Like, you're going to cast this card on a Tarka Red, and they're going to have to read it. They're going to be like, wait, what does that do? And you're like, oh, well, it does this. And they'll go, oh, I should, that seems good.
So, I actually think this is kind of more of a reaction to decks like his own. A lot of times you can get Snapping Gnarled, Den Protectors, and a Warden, possibly, with Rising Miasma, whereas the other card that you could play that beats Mono Red, which is Virulent Plague, doesn't get creatures or doesn't hit cards from other decks. So I think you're right when you say it's four Mono Red, but I think it is Rising Miasma instead of Virulent Plague because you still want it to hit a lot of creatures. I know that's or you want it to hit a lot of cards instead of just
tokens. No. And I think against, like, an Esper Tokens deck, too, like, if they don't have, like, a Gideon Emblem out, like, when they play, just to keep applying pressure, you can turn four, untap, play this. Like, they might not expect it from you. Like, they might not expect it, and they go, oh. And then the rest of the games, they just have to keep it on four mana. They have this pseudo board wipe that can knock out a lot of your tokens if you don't have enough, like, prowess triggers to keep them alive.
Yeah.
And it still kills their Secure the Waste tokens. Like, if they do, like, a big Secure the Waste for the six, and they attack and, you know, you block and you take, like, what, three or four, then you untap and play this. I mean, they're just worth their entire board.
That's a good point.
And
that
is a very good point. A lot of the dudes in the Abzan aggro deck survive it, too.
Yeah.
It helps.
Definitely.
I mean, snapping Gnarlid and a Dim Protector might bite the dust, but, I mean, everything else, like you said, everything else survives. I mean, Gideon tokens don't, but...
Meh. Who cares about him? Alright, so let's move on to... well, congratulations, Caleb, sure, who I guarantee doesn't listen to this podcast. we'll move on to second place to... Alright, Vidianto Wijaya. Did I get that right?
Oh, yeah. I'm gonna get it. Yep. Right. That is him.
Yeah, alright. So in Modern, he played Grixis Control, and again, okay, so I haven't looked at Grixis lists in a while, really, but, so I noticed a few changes from back in my day when I first started building Grixis. We've gone down to 3 Snapcaster Mages, gone up to 4 Jace Rin's Prodigy, 2 Fia and Kirin Nalar, and 2 Tasker the Golden Fang as your creature package, and then most decks just do some variation of some numbers of a bunch of counterspells. Lightning Bolts, Colagons, Commands. This one has Inquisition of Kozilek, which I find interesting. I haven't seen that in the main board of this deck lately. And I also note the lack of Cryptic Command.
Yeah, Grixis Control tends to not play Cryptic Command anymore. Like, if you look back at the old Modern Grixis lists, the ones that were, like, Cruel Control decks and stuff like that, you always had Cryptic Commands. But these lists are more about utilizing everything that you have. Every single card almost is a 2-for-1. Colgan's Command, or just like the most efficient spell at what it does in Modern. So like Thoughtscour helps fill up your graveyard as like a Rite of Flame that says draw a card on it. Inquisition uses the card to take a card. Painful Truce gets you ahead 2 cards. Rise Fall is insane. It can either bounce a creature your opponent controls to their hand, and then you buy back a creature from your graveyard.
In a graveyard,
yeah. Well, technically, you want to bounce a creature in play that someone has. So, like, someone else's creature and a creature from your graveyard is usually what you want to do. Now, it's a sorcery, so it doesn't beat... what's the card I'm thinking? It doesn't beat the Grixis deck, but you can also make them... him to Turak, essentially. They discard 2 cards at random from their hand, and if they discard, what is it? Oh, they reveal 2 cards at random, excuse me. And if they're non-lands, they discard them. So it can be like a him to Turak. It can be a bouncer dude and buy back my creature. It's like the extra copy of Colgan's Command in the deck. So it's kind of trying to do what Jeskai Black does in Standard. It just outvalues you over and over and over again. Until you have all of the resources and your opponent has no resources. So it's a hard deck to play, believe it or not. You have to make a lot of on-the-spot decisions without knowing 100% what your opponent has. So it's one of those decks that rewards you for knowing the format.
I mean, one of the cool things with Rise and Fall, though, like, you can use the Rise part just on yourself. Like, you can be like, I'm going to get back a Tassigor, a Pia and Kira Nalar, I'm going to bounce my Snapcaster Mage. Oh, I still have 3 mana left. I can Snapcaster Bolt something, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely.
You can do some insane stuff with that card. So yeah, when I read that card, I'm like, wow, this has a lot of versatility. Like, yeah, it can do a lot of different things. And
yeah, it's a very versatile card.
I've never seen it played that in my life.
Yeah, if someone played that against me, I'd be like, what the hell does this do? And I'm like, oh, this is really good. Well, guess you got this one, guy.
All of the value.
So, let's see.
Those Blood Moons in the sideboard.
Yep, Blood Moon's back, baby.
Blood Moons everywhere, yeah. Escorted by the SCG crew.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Blood Moons in Grixis Control is ballsy, man. Like, it's something a lot of people play, but you only play 4 basics, and that's another reason they don't play Cryptic Command, but still.
Right. Any more Grixis seems to lean very heavy black-red.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's this... you know, less so on the blue or counter spells. Some of the more value stuff, but
counter squall
spells.
Counter squall, super good card.
Yeah, I remember the first time I found that card, and I think I messed it, or Brad was asking me something to play in some Grixis deck, and I found that card and was like, "What about this one?" And just he was like, "Oh yeah, okay, yeah, all right."
Oh yeah. But yeah, I love that card.
I'm going to look into getting like 40. Okay, so let's see. Let's go back to standard then, which he was, hey, look, not too far off the same kind of strategy, playing Esper Dragons. So clearly we have a control player. I like this deck because it brought Ugin back.
Yeah, Ugin wasn't seeing any play. And then, like,
he's not an Esper Dragon. Ramp.
Yeah, but those other Ugins don't know how to act.
Like, I haven't seen a ramp deck in forever. Like, I haven't seen one in weeks. Like, it just fell off the map.
It did not.
No, it exists. People are just more prepared for it now. Yeah. All the infinite obliterations running around have kind of scared it off for a little while. But it shall return.
Yeah.
It's so mine. Go ahead.
I like this list because it's basically just going back to what Esper Dragons does best. It's just, I'm going to play the best cards in my deck. I'm going to play Dixie Times and Stoneguard Scorn with a bunch of dragons. I got four Jaces. I've got this one over-the-top card that you can't beat if I get there. And I have all of the card draw in the wheel to get there. So I do dislike a little bit that there's only one Haven in the list. He is playing a Plains instead of a sixth island and has an extra fetch land. So he's playing three Shambling Vents, where I've been playing two. He's playing a single Haven of the Spirit Dragon, where I've been playing two. And he has a Plains and a Bloodstained Mire instead of an Island and a Swamp, which, when you look at it, he's playing an extra Murderous Cut, and, he did trim a Dig Through Time, though, so I'm kind of confused. He's going up on fetch lands and adding a basic, but, actually, no, he cut a basic.
Maybe it's just Flip Jace more often. I don't know. Like, more fetch lands will just give you the probability that you can flip your Jace more often.
Two Taskers on the sideboard, too.
Yeah, true. Like, so more than Taskers, you get more Delve. And
that's definitely very old school right there.
Yeah.
Monastery
Mentors on the side.
Oh, yeah. Monastery Mentors just starting to pick up popularity again. It dived down a lot. Like,
it's a good list. This list is very good. I don't want to say it looks like a bad list or anything, but it's a little different.
Well, time to get my last Jace.
Yeah, they are not going anywhere in price. That is definitely true.
At least they've gone back down to like $60. Like,
yeah, they've definitely dropped.
The
$70
Jace era.
Or the $80 Jace era is finally over.
Yes, I'm done with that. I quit.
I mean, I got the first two Jaces I ever got, I got them at $60 value. And then the last one, which was at Kansas City Open, I'm like, you know what? I'll just get one. You know, three's enough. Like, I don't need to get... I'm not going to get four yet. I don't even know what I'm going to play him in. Like, I still don't know what I want to play him in. Like, it's a good card. I don't know what to play.
Yeah. But it's good stuff. I mean, this looks pretty straightforward. Still the control-y, dragon-y, counter stuff and kill stuff hits you.
Oh, yeah.
I always liked that strategy of hitting things with dragons. I mean, now with... When Dragons of Tarkir came out and people said you can build a control deck and still hit people with dragons, I was all for that.
Yep, I jumped on board.
Okay, so let's go to third place. Another modern deck that shows up. Teamer Twin, piloted by Casey Portes? Portes? Pords. One of those three, probably.
One of them, yeah.
Teamer Twin, also known as Tarmo Twin, usually. Is this Tarmo Twin, though?
Yeah, it's the same.
Okay, yep, there's the Glaives. yeah, okay, so let's talk Bounding Krasis in Modern. What's up with that? Like, it's a good card. I just want to hear what you guys have to say about
it. It's a bolt.
Yeah, so here's what my argument, I guess, is. I was very adamant that this card is not good in Modern. Just because it dies to bolt. That was my argument. And I started listening to Patrick Dickmon talk about it, and the more you think about it, it does the exact same thing as Pestermite, which is the other card that you're going to be playing in this deck. And it still dies
to bolt.
Whereas this can give you a card that will block some things in the early game, and Pestermite can't really do that. Now, you can argue that evasion is better to have so you can get a clock on, which is true. But when you have the ability to play a bigger creature, there's no reason to not play the bigger creature, I think, in this instance. Pestermite is a little bit more flexible because I think it says target permanent. Now, admittedly, I haven't looked at a Pestermite in a long time, but Pestermite says when it comes into play, tap or untap target permanent, so it's a little bit more flexible. But I just think Burning Crisis is fine. I don't think it's any better or worse than Crisis, but it's fine.
I mean, I guess both of them, like, if you're playing against another twin player, if they went to, like, attach Splinter Twin, like, couldn't you, in response, when they make a token, tap down that token? Oh, wait, it wouldn't do anything. I don't know where I was going with that. I don't play Twin.
I was going to say, no. Jason doesn't know how to play Twin, which is admittedly more than I know about
Twin. I don't know how to play Twin. Two cryptic commands in the main board, though.
That's pretty common for Twin anymore, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I think it's more common for, like, Tamer Twin. Like, I don't know about other Twin decks, but I've seen, like, maybe one Cryptic Command main board.
Grixis Twin has kind of fallen off the map lately, as you'll notice. Most of the people that are playing Grixis with Terminates and Colgan's Command have migrated to the control list, whereas the blue-red Twin decks play at least one Cryptic Command, sometimes two or three. Not that that's a huge deal. It's Cryptic Command. It's good in a control deck, but...
Yeah.
Good deal. Okay, what was he playing in Standard? Four Color Rally. Hey, look, another pretty much combo deck with a bunch of creature stuff.
I'm conveniently four Jace.
You know, not that I think the deck is bad, but I'm sick of hearing about Four Color Rally. Sick of hearing about it.
Yeah, my main thing about it, too, is that, I mean, there's nothing innovative anyone can do with it because it's exactly. So reliant on having four of everything to just give you advantage, which is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that in general, but, I mean, nothing can really be subbed out, interestingly. Yep. I mean, it's the same stuff in different numbers in a sideboard, and that's about it.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
I mean, like,
Casey Port is for playing a boring deck.
And, yeah. I mean, a lot of people go, like, oh, odds on aggro is the same. I'm like, well, yeah, but, like, some people make some weird changes, like one ofs and two ofs, and, like, each week it can change each week, and it can still run the same. But, like, Rally, if you shave, like, one number for one other thing, it kind of throws the deck off.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're an odds on aggro player, so.
Yeah. And?
Which means I don't value your opinion. I'm joking, obviously, but...
That's hard to read, Master Race. Anyway, so let's move down to fourth place. Christopher Giuliano in Modern was playing Jund, often referred to as the most expensive deck in Modern. I can totally see why. So, I don't know Jund very well, so maybe one of you could enlighten me. I know Jund beats me, and it's usually with something stupid, so someone enlighten me here.
I mean, Jund and Abzan, like, they relatively play, like, Abzan doesn't play Dark Confidant, like, the attrition Abzan deck doesn't play Dark Confidant, but... Other than that, they play about the same, except for, like, Colgan's Commands and Bolts and Terminates. They play about the same list, but I think Colgan's Command is, like, a very good card. I mean, who wouldn't play Lightning Bolt, because Lightning Bolt's one of the best removal spells. But also Terminate. And, I mean, Dark Confidant just creates such an advantage engine, too. I mean, even though one of my Jund opponents in the IQ killed themselves with a Tassigur because they were at six.
Oh, which, God.
It was really funny. And you can see, like, it's a one of in the deck. And he was shocked. He was just like, why Tassigur? And I'm like, it's the game you play when you play with Dark Confidant. But, I mean, I don't know. That's my, like, I think Jund and Junk are about the same, but they just have their own innovations, like, their own things to side out for other things.
Fair. How about you, Mike?
To me, Jund is just a deck that plays a bunch of really, really good cards that are better than what everybody else is playing. And when you get down to no cards in hand, it top decks better than anything else in the format. Like, that's just, to me, that's how it works. Now, a lot of their cards are value cards, like Maelstrom Pulse kills extra creatures or permanents. Inquisition takes their best card that costs less than three. Terminate kills everything. Colgan's Command lets you rebuy stuff. Abrupt Decay just beats everything that costs less than three. So,
which is ever, like, a lot of things in Modern.
Yeah, exactly. It's not an insanely busted deck, and you're absolutely right that it's incredibly expensive, but it's one of those decks that rewards you, again, for being a solid player. If you know your deck inside and out, it's going to be hard to lose on a consistent basis with Jund. It's just so powerful innately. And it doesn't have, you're not allowed access to any of the best cards that it used to have anymore, like Bloodbraid Elf and DRS. So Dark Confidant just is insane in a deck like this. Tastiger hurts a little bit, so it's kind of surprising to see one of those in the main board, but it's still pretty solid.
Now, is Outpost Siege usually run in the sideboard with these decks?
It gives you a way to side into bigger threats, like 4 and 5 drops, if you're playing them, and still get value out of them. Like, you don't want to side into Thrag Tusk and then keep in all 4 of your Dark Confidants. That's just not a good idea.
Not a game you want to play.
Now, most of the matchups where you side in Thrag Tusk, you're not putting an Outpost Siege anyway because it's a burn matchup, but it gives you a way to draw your cards still without dying to Dark Confidant.
Neat.
And it's good in the mirror because you get an extra, like, draw an extra card per turn, essentially, where you keep in your Dark Confidants and everything, and you draw a card off Dark Confidant, you reveal a card to Outpost Siege, and now you're 2 cards ahead. So
good deal. All right, so in Standard, this gentleman was playing Red-Black Dragons, and that's not a meta deck we've seen in a while, so I'm just going to run through it pretty quick. It's got 21 creatures, 4 Hangerback Walker, 4 Flamewake Phoenix, 4 Monastery Swift Spear, 4 Thunderbreak Regent, 2 Kolaghan the Storm's Fury, 3 Zergo Bellstriker. It's got 24 lands, 15 spells that are 4 Draconic Roar, 3 Kolaghan's Command, 2 Murderous Cut, 4 Wild Slash, and 2 Exquisite Firecraft. The sideboard is 2 Scab Clan, Berserkers, 2 Outpost Siege, 2 Negate, 2 Ultimate Price, 3 Duress, and 4 Self-Inflicted Wound. Let's start from the top, shall we?
Sunken Hollow.
Okay, yes. Sunken Hollow is a one-of, which, you know, fine, sure, fetch, get your black land, whatever. But for a negate in the sideboard is just nuts.
I really want to know how many people he blew out with that. Sorry, I had to...
Probably enough.
True. Very true.
The one thing I've always found fascinating about the red-black deck, ever since Battle for Zendikar came out, there have been a couple different versions of it floating around, is that it's kind of this weird mash of, like, red aggro and then, like, good black stuff. And then dragons, too. It's very kind of the mid-range strategy of just hitting your curve, and you don't see that as often anymore. Like, you have Abzan, and that's about it.
I think part of the problem for other decks in that vein is that Abzan just does it so well. Like, Abzan and Atarka Red just do it so much better than everybody else. Now, Atarka Red doesn't curve out, I get that, but when you're trying to put fair, or rather more fair creatures into play, I shouldn't call them fair because you still play Swift Spear and Thunderbreak. Yeah. But they are more fair than what, like, Abzan Aggro is playing in a 1-mana 3-drop or 1-mana 3/3 or 4/5/4. But I won't get into that.
So when you have a play that's turn 1 Zergo Bellstriker, turn 2 Hangerback Walker, turn 3 Flamewake Phoenix, turn 4 Thunderbreak Regent, I mean, you're just winning at that point.
Yeah, you're in a great spot.
And the fact that it's completely and utterly and entirely possible to do that with, you know, hardly any issue. It's kind of disgusting, and it's great to have a deck where Exquisite Firecraft's getting played, and I need to steal my wife's Hangerback Walkers so I can build this.
And if like, all the Draconic Wars had a reveal every single time, and all the Wild Slashes and the Exquisite Firecrafts, that's 28 burn. So you can, in theory, burn out an opponent, too.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, it's a lot of burn. And, I mean, Ferocious on Wild Slash, never, like, you don't see it, but in this deck it's very easy to do.
Oh, yeah, it is very easy to do.
It's just, like, damage can't be prevented. It's like, oh.
Bye-bye, Dreamilk's Command.
Get wrecked.
Yep.
Get wrecked. I actually watched the Christopher play against Joe Lissette, and he just wrecked Bring the Light. Because that deck just, like, they even interviewed Joe Lissette, they're like, You know you're playing against Red Black Dragons. How many games? He's like, I put in quite a bit of games last night. He's like, it's not good. He's like, I just get wrecked by the deck.
Yep.
And he's like, after sideboard, it's even worse for me. He's like, I'll try to give it my best, but if anything, I don't see myself getting past this matchup.
I love that negate in the sideboard. Like,
yeah.
That is some next level mystical shit right there.
Because, like, game one, I doubt you'll see the Sunken Hollow. So you're just like, oh, it's just red-black. And then they get the Sunken Hollow, and you're like, okay, this is weird.
It probably doesn't even register to most people at that point.
Yeah. They're just like, oh, it's a swamp. Okay, cool. And then they get negated, and they're like, what the hell just happened?
Yup. I love it. Oh, my God, I'm so in love with this deck. I want to make
Till.
It. I'm going to make
it. It's pretty.
I'm going to make it.
Cheap,
I'm going to make love do it.
Oh, yeah. It's, like, I mean, Hangerback Walkers are probably the only expensive creature.
They're not even that bad anymore.
That's true. Like, and I have four. They're just in my life standard deck, so I'll just have to steal it. I'll have to find my Draconic Roars, though. I don't know where they went. Anyway, so let's move on from that. We will go to fifth place, Alex Smith, playing Infect.
Oh, good old Infect.
Yep, super straightforward. Nothing fancy at all.
Is Dryad Arbor played in Infect?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
It's against, like, Liliana.
You don't see it very often, but it's, or you don't ever see it, because Liliana is a lot less prevalent than it used to be, but it helps you beat Liliana. They play Liliana fetch, or they play Liliana minus, and you just fetch and go get a Dryad Arbor and stack the Dryad Arbor.
Yep.
Hey. I'm trying to see if there's any I find interesting. Okay, Spell Pierce in the main board, is that pretty common anymore?
It was. I haven't seen it played that way in a while, but that doesn't mean it's not normal. I haven't played against Infect on Modo in weeks and weeks. So.
Because good thing to note, though, and Patrick Sullivan actually noted, like, when he was on camera, he played a Sylvan's Crying, and they go, Sylvan's Crying, and they're like, yeah, he's playing it as a 2-of because it allows him to get, like, Inkmoth, which is, like, the alternate game plan if you lose your Blighted Agent if you lose your Blighted Agent, you just have to kill him with an Inkmoth. And it helps you get your landfall from your for your groundswells.
Pendlehaven.
Yeah, not near as good as Crop Rotation in Legacy.
Yeah.
But
we can't play Crop Rotation.
Still very good, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, all right, I think I've seen Mo before. Except for Piracy Charm. I've never, ever seen that card in my entire life.
That card should be called the Tom Ross Special.
Target creature gains Island Walk until end of turn, or target creature gets +2/-1 until end of turn, or target player discards a card, all for the low, low price of 1 blue.
Yeah, when they decided that they were going to take Funeral Charm and make it blue, they were stupid. I don't know why they did that. I have no clue.
That definitely was silly of them, and it was ridiculous. This deck scares me, and so let's go see what he's playing in Standard. Oh, hey, look, Jeskai Black.
What value?
It's a different kind of Jeskai Black than we're used to seeing.
It's a Monastery Mentor Jeskai Black.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
We'll go over this one since this is not something we've really seen before. Mike, why don't you go through this while I pet my cat?
So 3 Monastery Mentor, 4 Soulfire Grandmaster, 4 Jace Vinge Prodigy, 26 lands, which I believe is one more than most Blacklists are playing right now, but I haven't done that in a while, so 4 Crackling Doom, 1 Dispel, 4 Fiery Impulse, 2 Colgan's Command, 2 Murderous Cut, 2 Agitized Command, 2 Duress, 2 Painful Truce, 2 Roast, and 2 Treasure Cruise. And in the sideboard we have 2 Urchin Cleric, 2 Master of the Unseen, 2 Dispel, 1 Erase, 1 Negate, 2 Dragonlord Ogitai, 1 Duress, 2 Radiant Flames, and 2 Self-Inflicted Wound.
Okay, so what's our take on this?
I like it.
The first thing I see is that it's actually super black heavy. Like, it's not a black deck. It's Jeskai that splashes black, but it has a lot more black in it than a lot of Jeskai decks are playing. And it could just be that there's not as many creatures, but yeah. It seems like there's more instances of black mana than there normally are.
Yeah, I would say you're correct on that.
I'm I'm loving the Painful Truths everywhere. Like, every deck is either playing them in the sideboard or mainboard now.
It's a good card.
That card has just caught wildfire.
I am really glad it's only a rare, and this was a very open set.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I will.
Dragonlord Ojutai is in the sideboard, though. Like, I think that's kind of an interesting one.
It's really good.
I don't know.
What do you bring in against, I guess?
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know what you...
Continue.
I mean, it doesn't have, like Esper Dragons has Silumgar Scorn to back it up to protect it, but you don't have that here. Like, you're relying on, like, duresses and dispels and negate to protect Ojutai, but sometimes that's just not enough.
Yeah, I can get that. Well, my biggest thing about the Dragon Lord, and let me say that I am not with you guys, I don't like it on the sideboard at all. So when you play against this deck, you don't really look like, I mean, you do because you have the same cards, but you don't really look like a Jeskai deck. You're playing control. It's not unheard of for your opponent to assume that you're on Dragonlord Ojutai. So if your opponent has a way to remove them, your opponent's going to side into those cards, and then you're siding into a card that makes that card active. And I'm not huge on that plan. So, like, against the control mirror, yeah, I think it's fine. I think your opponent is, you're going to overload your opponent's removal spell with Monastery Mentors, and Monastery Mentor already makes Foul Tongue Invocation really bad. But I think Dragonlord Ojutai, while not bad necessarily, is a little bit of an odd sideboard choice, at least as a 2-1.
Yeah.
That's fair. I mean,
I'm just worried that, like, you wouldn't have the ability to protect it like Esper Dragons can.
Yeah. Oh, and that's definitely true.
No, guys. The key is you just never attack.
just sit there.
Just leave Ojutai as hexproof, and you'll be golden.
Until it dies to a freaking fully pumped Lightning Berserker on turn 6.
Hey, I've done that.
I know.
That was awesome. All right. Okay, so, I mean, well, it's definitely a different take. It's still more or less the same strategy that Jeskai Black takes, you know, Jace stuff and then Soulfire Grandmaster stuff.
Yep, rebuy all your spells.
But with this case, you have Monastery Mentor, which you're getting just insane value out.
Yeah, that combination is not something that was missed in Standard by any stretch. It's been a well-known combination. But I think this is one of the first decks where it's been somewhat abusable.
Yep. All right, so 6th is Joe set, playing Green-Red Tron in Modern. Do we see anything particularly interesting here?
He's playing Conduit, a one of Conduit of Ruin in the main board.
Okay.
Which, on the outside, it's like, okay, this is fine. But when they talked about it in his, player profile, because, like, before the top 8, they went through the Modern and was like, why did you choose this? And he's like, well, I played a Conduit of Ruin. He's like, halfway through the first round, I'm like, this card was a mistake. And he's like, I think I boarded it out, like, every single time. I never gave it a real good chance. But, like, in this situation, wouldn't you rather play a Worm Coil? Like, it's the same cost.
But
it doesn't, I mean, I guess it doesn't fetch up, like, your Ulamog.
If your game plan, like, the games where you draw Eye of Ugin naturally, or get to put it into play on turn 4 naturally,
yeah.
And you can just, oh, well, I have 7 to 10 mana in play, I will have 7 to 10 mana next turn, you just go get Conduit of Ruin, play it. If they can't kill it, you go get Emrakul. Well, if it resolves, you go get Emrakul. You play your Eye of Ugin. So now Emrakul costs 13. You untap, and, well, you have to get Ulamog, I guess, because Emrakul would cost 1 more than what you want it to cost on turn 4, or on turn 5, rather. Well, that's a bummer. But still, casting an Ulamog on turn 5 is
pretty insane.
Pretty good in that deck.
Very cool. Now, I don't know the deck very well, so is Conduit of Ruin really the only difference from what's normally run in these kinds of lists?
Yeah.
Yeah, the deck is pretty stock.
He's got the extra Worm Coil and Ulamog in the sideboard.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's playing like a one of, he's playing a third Ghost Quarter in the sideboard, which I don't know what the land's like. I don't know if they played I mean, I've only seen, like, one ghost quarter out of Tron players.
Yeah, the extra ghost quarter or two is for, gosh.
Would it be against, like, the mirror?
That one deck. Well, it's partially for the mirror, but it's also against Titan, Bloom Titan. That deck that I can never remember, except for...
Because they only play one basic, too.
Sometimes, some lists have been playing two, but yeah, it's basically to hate them out.
Yeah, and plus if you get, like, if you get Crucible of Worlds plus Ghost Quarter, it's like,
yeah.
I'm going to strip mine you out of the game.
Yep.
Return.
Yep. You'll see a lot of Jund decks or, like, more fair decks that will play a Ghost Quarter in the sideboard and a single copy of Life from the Loam, and that's just their game plan against Titan, because... They have Ghost Quarters and Tech Edges already in the main deck, so they just turn into every turn I'm gonna strip mine you with my Ghost Quarter. So until you run out of lands, this is the game plan.
Yep.
Gross. Alright, yep. Well, Lissette in Standard was playing 5-color Bring to Light, which is a deck that, you know, hasn't been around much lately. I don't think it's not that it's not good. It's just that other decks are better.
Again, no argument here.
Yeah, so since we haven't seen it in a while, Justin, why don't you take us through the list, and then we'll go over it.
All right. He's playing 3 Den Protector, 4 Siege Rhino. I'm already on board. 4 Jace Friends Prodigy, 2 Nissa Vastward Seer, playing an assortment of 26 lands, including 1 Lumbering Falls as, like, the only main land, which Lumbering Falls can win games on its own.
Definitely.
4 Obzon Charm, 2 Complete Disregard, 1 Crackling Doom, 1 Dispel, 1 Culligan's Command, 1 Negate, 1 Silumgar's Command, 2 Utter End, 3 Bring Delight, 1 Languish, 1 Radiant Flames, and 3 Treasure Cruise mainboard. And the sideboard, he's got 1 Dispel, 2 Hollowed Moonlight, 1 Negate, 4 Surge of Righteousness, 1 Anaphens of the Foremost, 1 Infinite Obliteration, 2 Painful Troops, 2 more Radiant Flames, and 1 Talent of the Telepath.
Oh yeah. Lord. Spicy meatball.
Spicy meatball.
Definitely.
In the interview, Nick Miller was like, now, Talent of the Telepath is one of those interesting cards. And Joe went on to explain that he was playing a 2-man one night, and he was playing the mirror, and his opponent cast a Talent of the Telepath and had Spell Mastery, and he got an Obzon Charm and a Treasure Cruise, so he drew 5 cards.
Ew.
And Joe was just like, holy crap, that card's insane.
Yep.
I mean, especially against, like, Esper Dragons or Esper Control, like, taking a Dig Through Time.
Yep.
Just seems nuts.
He cast this card against Jerry Thompson, who was playing Jeskai Black, and I believe got 10th place in the Invitational. But he cast it against Jerry Thompson and hit, like, Negate, Painful Truce, Treasure Cruise, Second Negate, and a Bring to Light. Or not a Bring to Light, a Fiery Impulse. So, like...
All the value.
He just goes, all right, kill your Jace, I'm not going to cast the Bring to Light, it can go to exile. Or I'm not going to cast the Negates, those can go to exile. And then I'll cast Painful Truce for 0. No, I think he let all 3 of the others go to exile. And now Jerry's just down a Painful Truce in both of his sideboard Negates.
Lord.
Yeah, like, now Joe didn't necessarily get value out of it when he cast it. But, like, think about that. Your opponent is playing, like, the Jeskai Black deck plays 2 Negates, a bunch of Ojitai's commands that counter creatures and not spells, and maybe 2 dispels. Like, you just put yourself on the road to value town. It's just, you're like driving a little steam engine with a hat on its on its cab. Like, check me out.
I'm going to value town.
Yeah.
True, literally... motherfuckers. Oh, well, you know, the good news is I only need 1 Jace, 2 Nissas, and, like, 2 Bring the Lights, and then I could build it and play it back.
I sold my Dead Protectors.
I just got my 4th.
I
did sell my 1 Nissa, though.
I had, I traded, I had 4 Dead Protectors, 2 of them and some other stuff for 2 foils, which the foils are just beautiful. So That's the only reason why I would ever, like, I usually only trade for foils. Cause they just,
who'd you get that? Who'd you get one of those foils from?
I think I got it from a guy who, at the time, it was worth, like, $8 or $9.
I'm pretty sure it was closer to, like, $6. I mean, I think I was there. I don't know. I might have been that guy.
What card are we talking about?
I mean, I remember at a time where I thought Hangar Backwalker was the worst card, and I opened a Korean one, and a guy was like, hey, I'll trade you a Languish for one. I'm like, yeah, those are straight across prices.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you got back. Ouch. Like, we're even, Mike.
I don't know. I think your $30 foil, Dent Protector, might be slightly more valuable than my...
Oh, they're not $30.
Okay. Well, then like I don't 20. Feel so bad.
They're like 20.
I don't feel so bad, though.
All right, gentlemen. Calm down now. Move on.
I'm calm.
To seventh place, Michael Cortez, Abzan Company.
Woo!
Again,
I love this deck.
Man, I need to learn modern. So I don't know. I don't think there's much anything interesting or new or innovative.
Nope. So last week when we talked about the weird cards in that one dude's Abzan Company, that I can't remember what the guy's name was. I feel bad now. But he was playing like Barrels, the Scarstripe, and what was the other? It was the standard card that's in Rally, the one that makes a 1/1.
Catacomb Sifter.
Catacomb Sifter, yeah. And this list just is the standard list. Like, we talked about how it was weird that Malaria Stonelock Outcast isn't there, and that it has Barrels and Catacomb Sifter. This list just has the Maliras, it has the Murderous Red Cap, and it has the third Viscerous Seer. So this guy's just like, well, I'm not worried about redundancy, about losing two cards like whatever, Surgical Extraction, stuff like that. We're just going to play the most consistent version of the list. And it's real, real standard. Like, it's real normal. Nothing fancy at all.
The thing, though, like, I love about Malaria, though, it's, like, so good in the Infect matchup. Yeah. Like, they just have bad beats.
You don't say.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point.
You can't get poison counters. Well, shit, you just won the game.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to Richard the other day, and I was asking him what cards for Bring the Light Scape Shift should I put in to help with my Infect matchup? And he goes, Malira? And I was like, oh, God, I forgot that card existed.
Gotcha.
Yes, please.
And, I mean, I love Kotaki Wars Wage in the sideboard, too, because I played a Kotaki on turn two against Affinity. They don't win.
Yeah.
They're done. They're done.
All right, so moving over to Standard then, since this guy doesn't know how to innovate. We've got Esper Midrange, which I don't know that it's necessarily innovative, but it's definitely different. It's not something we stumble upon frequently. So I'll run through this list. We've got 15 creatures, 3 Archangel Tithe, 4 Knight of the White Orchid, 4 Wasteland Strangler, 4 Wingmate Rock. It's got 4 Gideon Ally of Zendikar, 25 lands. It's got 16 spells, Silkwrap as a 4-of, 4 Stasis Snare, 1 Murderous Cut, 2 Secure the Waste, 1 Ultimate Price, and 4 Transgress the Mind. And the sideboard is another Archangel of Tithes, 2 Mastery of the Unseen, 3 Disdainful Stroke, 2 Dispel, 1 Murderous Cut, 1 Ultimate Price, 3 Valorous Stance, and 2 Painful Truths. So
this is kind of the white-black mid-range deck that Craig Wesko, I think he did, was it a GP that he did kind of semi-well in?
I think it was a TCG player event.
And so, like, they call it Esper Midrange, but it's only splashing blue for the sideboard, Disdainful Strokes and Dispels, which are pretty good. No, I think this deck's... I've been wanting to play Knight of the White Orchid. Just Value Town.
Well, you don't get to draw cards off it, so...
Well, yeah,
I don't know if I go that far, but...
You go, like, they play their third land and go, you untap, you play your Knight, you get a Plains card, and then you play your other land.
Yeah,
you're up. Like, you get above them, even though... Like, you get one land up on them, even though they're on the play.
Yeah. Well, let's call it, like, Value Village or Value City.
Okay. So we're taking the Value Train to Value City?
from Value Town. Like, you're taking a step backwards a little bit. But it's, I mean, it's still value, but it's not. Yeah.
Okay, so I gotta get this out now, then. What would we, like, value Metropolis?
Painful Truths for 5.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm. That's impossible.
I would get on board with that so fast.
Yeah. I don't know how.
So fast. The best part about that is, though, is that it's supposed to be a bad thing for you if you're casting Painful Truths for 5, but it's actually insane.
Yeah. Like, it's okay, like, oh, I'm going to draw some kind of card.
Crazy death and taxes list.
Nah,
to be able to do that.
You just have to be playing Bring to Light, and your opponent has 2 Grand Wingmares in play.
Well, yeah. But Patrick Chapin was playing Painful Truths as a one of and like some Esper Legacy, like Esper Mentor, like in Legacy, and he was playing against Hate Bears, like a Hate Bears as like a Death and Taxes list, and there was a Thalia out, and it was 4, and he goes, and he had 4 mana, like he had 4 different colors. He goes, Painful Truths for 4, I'll draw 4, and his opponent read it, and he's like, oh, Thalia made it cost an extra color. And he's like, yeah, I have the 4th color. He's like, yeah. I'm going to draw 4 and gain 4, like, lose 4. And his opponent was like, oh, wow. Yeah. This is, like, insane.
Death Rite Shaman for the 4th color. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So that's actually I think the thing that I want to do in Standard right now, like, repeatedly, is cast Talon of the Telepath with buyback. Like, cast Talon of the Telepath off of a Soulfire Grandmaster, and just recast it.
Okay, all right, hold on. We're skipping around here. The issue at hand, Archangel of Tithes is one of the most underappreciated cards from Orc.
Yeah, I would definitely agree to that. I think part of the problem is that its stats, like, if you cover the text box, its stats are very underwhelming. And even when you uncover the text box, its stats are very underwhelming for the mana cost that you have, the mana restriction. I shouldn't say mana cost 4 isn't bad, but the mana restriction that you're forced to pay. So if this cost white 2, it wouldn't be seeing as much play as Gideon.
Yep.
If it was a 4/5 instead of being a 3/5, it would see as much play as Siege Rhino. But because of those two things, like, the abilities are just good regardless. Like, they're just great. But if either of those things were true, and not necessarily at the same time, they would see much more play. It's just the fact that you can't splash it in the decks that are playing multiple colors in a format where everybody wants to play multiple colors is a severe drawback, even though normally it's just like, oh, well, I guess I'll only play 2 colors and then this will be my main color. You can't do that in this format. Even your main color is very hard to splash away from it. With 3 mana symbols per card. Yep, so
that's fair. I just think that, you know, I remember the first time I had that played against me in a game of Standard.
Oh, yeah. And
I had no idea what to do from there.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, well, that's a thing. Good game. There's so many decks that are completely ill-equipped to deal with it, honestly.
I'm sorry. Something to think about with this card, if this was a 2/4 and cost triple white, do you think it would see play?
A 2/4?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Dies the language. Well, like, in that sense, it dies the language. So, like, when language...
lots of board wipes.
Well, yeah, but when language first came out, that was the most talked about, because it went right into Obs on Control.
And that's fair.
Siege Rhino and... Or, like, this card would be, like, $2 at this point. Like, it's still, like, a $4 to $5 Mythic Rare, which is pretty decent. But, like, I think that extra toughness, even though it's just a 3/5, that extra toughness actually matters.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree. It was more of just a, I wonder if this is true.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, I don't know.
That's my thoughts on it. I mean, it's a pretty interesting deck, of course, with the exiling things and wasteland strangling things.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, really just, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You turn cards sideways and win.
Mm-hmm.
So
you just turn 5 wingmate raid and you look at your opponent like, can you kill the wingmate?
Yeah.
I will say, the transgress the mines in the main board, I think this is just a copy pasta of the other Craig Wisco list. Now, that might be, like, doing a disservice to Mike Cortez here, but Wesco was playing four Transgress the Mind, and at the time, almost every deck in the format, except for Mono Red, was playing majority cards that cost three or more. And that's not really the case anymore.
Yeah.
There are, like, three very popular decks that play stuff that is less than three, or less than, what is it, three or four?
It's three.
Yeah, less than three. So, I think Transgress the Mind is a good card, I don't know that I would be playing four of it in the main board. I think there are better things to be doing with that slot in the current format. Now, it was great when Wesco was playing it, but I think this is a pretty stock list because that is still in it.
Yeah.
And I think when Wesco, like, posted that article, like, that's when, like, Eldrazi Ramp was, like, a big thing before, like, all the Infinite Obliterations kind of just scared them all out of the meta. But, like, that, because he was just like, well, because I don't even know if he was playing Infinite Obliteration. He's like, well, Transgress the Mind is going to just slow them down to the point where we're going to just beat them down with, like, Knights and Wasteland Stranglers. And then we're going to, like, Silkwrap and Stasis Snare their mana dorks and their Jotty offshoots so we can, and then we'll Wasteland Stranger them and, like, do silly stuff. Like, you just try to delay them as slow as possible. That way you can kill them. But.
Well, that and Jeskai Black with the Mantis Strike. I mean, the only cards then that were any less than Jace's and Soulfire Grandmasters weren't getting played at first.
True.
But, you know, once those caught on, I think it's... So, it's good, you know, interesting to see a pretty different deck, you know, has been doing pretty well the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks or so. I mean, not winning, but still doing okay. So let's move on. Eighth place, we have Justin Rios. In Modern, he played Green-Red Tron, which, again, not a whole lot new. I noticed there's no Emrakul on this list.
What?
He's running the not new Eldrazi thing.
Oh, my God.
He's not playing the Emrakul.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta play the one of Emrakul, right?
Like, yeah, there's a reason he got eight.
So, why would you not, like, what is the argument for not playing Emrakul? Why would you do that?
Oh, yeah.
That makes no sense.
Extra like, Ugin?
There's so many.
But Ugin doesn't
win
the game.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm if trying to come up with ideas, and I'm empty.
I know. I know you're just being that guy, but, like, it makes no sense to me. So, story time, kiddies, and it's brief, but...
Oh, so, thanks, Grandpa.
No, anytime. Grand Prix Kansas City a couple years ago, Modern GP, I was playing Blue-White Tron, and I had an Emrakul in my deck. And this is how I learned this lesson. This is why you never cut Emrakul from a Tron deck. So, this is after sideboard. This is game two. I win the round. I go on to win the round, so it's not a sob story. But round two, I'm playing against Birthing Pod. And I'm like, okay, well, he's either going to combo me out before I find enough lands to play Emrakul, or I'm going to play a Terastodon or a Thundering Titan, and I'm just going to blow up all of his lands, and then I'm going to win the game on the back of a 7-10. Well, we get to that point, and I blow up a whole bunch of his lands, and he passed my dude. And I'm like, okay, well, he brought in a place that I passed out of the sideboard, so this is going to be a long game. So I go get Worm Coils, and he passed those, and he passed those, and I go get Iona, and what did he do? Like, killed it with one of the creatures that kills a non-black, non-artifact creature when it comes into play. It wasn't...
Shriekmaw?
I think maybe it was Shriekmaw. It wasn't Necrotal, which is the one that always pops in my head first. Anyway, to get to the point of this story, I finally find my Eye of Ugin. So now I'm just going through. I'm finding Worm Coil 2, Worm Coil 3, and I cast him, and he always has a Path to Exile. I'm like, geez, man, come on. You got to run out of those eventually. So he casts the fourth Path to Exile, and I'm like, yes, I get to go get Emrakul now, and I kill him. And I draw the land that lets me cast Emrakul. So I play it, I pass the turn. Not doing anything. I'm holding up counter magic. I'm holding up spot removal. He draws his card, plays the land, no cards in his hand. And I'm like, sweet. Pay 6 mana, activate Eye of Ugin, go get Emrakul, kill you. And he goes, sure, show it to me. So I start looking through my deck, and I look, and I'm like, oh my god, I sided out my Emrakul. I don't have a win condition left in my deck except for Celestial Colonnade. So instead of just killing him on the spot, I'm trying to kill him with a 4-4 Celestial Condor, and he's at, like, 16. So instead of one hit, wipe out all of his permanents, and then he's just dead, I hit him for 4 with a Celestial Colonnade. He draws a card, plays Ranger of Eos, goes gets 2 1-drops, plays the 2 1-drops. I untap, I hit him for 4 with Celestial Colonnade, play another land, and he rips a Birthing Pod off the top of the deck, plays a Birthing Pod, pods out a 1-drop into a Phantasmal Image, copying Ranger of Eos, goes and gets 2 more 1-drops, passes the turn back to me, and I put him to 4, and he rips... what was it? Rips something off the top of the deck. It was either Kitchen Finks or something to pod into Kitchen Finks. And I was like, oh, well, that's awesome. And just effectively combos me out over the course of 4 turns because I sided out my Emrakul. So the moral of the story is do not play Emrakul. Like, it is the deck to play him in. Like, that's the entire reason it is there in those lists. That's why they play 1. It's why they play Eye of Ugin. So why play Eye of Ugin if you're just going to play a 10-drop that you can cast for 10 most of the time anyway on turn 4? It just doesn't make sense.
That's fair. Yeah. All right. Well, besides that questionable decision, is there anything else interesting?
Crumble the Dust finally starting to pop up.
Yes.
It was going to happen eventually. Like, don't misunderstand me. It was going to happen no matter what. But it's just a strict upgrade on Sowing Salt.
Yep. I'm so excited to see it. Okay, anything else you guys want to hit before we move on to the last standard deck?
Crumble to Dust. If you're playing the mirror, always take the tower.
Always. Oh, even if you're not playing the mirror, take the tower. If you're playing red the deck tower. Against Tron, take the tower.
Because they always have, like, they usually have a, like, if they play it, like, if they have Tron, and you're trying to figure out what land to blow up, if you can blow up land like a Fulminar Mage, I always blow up the tower in hopes they don't have a tower, and then next time they play a tower, I'm like, this did nothing. I'm screwed.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like they always have a backup tower, but they never have, like, a backup power plant or mine. And I think it's just because the tower taps for 3 when they have Tron.
To be fair, when you crumble to dust them, it doesn't matter which Tron land you take, because for the rest of the game, they all make 1 colorless mana. But I understand what you're getting at there. It's the one that you want to kill.
Yep.
Just screw the tower.
All right, so the last standard deck by Justin Rios was, you guessed it, Abzan Aggro.
Yep. This is more of like a stock list. With
yes.
Like, he's playing a 4 Dim Protector and 3 Air of the Wilds. He's also playing the 4 Fold Gideon, where we've seen some lists just go down to 3, which I think 3 is just fine. You don't need to play 4.
That's silly. I mean, you don't, but...
Yeah. His sideboard seems fine. I'm curious, like, he's playing 2 Murderous Cut already in the main board, and then he has an extra Murderous Cut.
He's not delving for anything else, so I think that's reasonable.
Well, yeah. I think it's reasonable, really, like, but, like, instead of the third cut, I just think playing, like, a Tassiger, like, just another good, efficient 4-5 body for 1 is fine. It's the same, like, you have an extra delve in there, but
you know,
I always play at least 1 Tassiger in the sideboard, because you never know, like, when you get in, like, the Esper Control and Esper Dragons matchups, like, Tassiger can just kind of take over and start getting more cards.
I think that argument is reasonable, but I think if you look at his list, playing what amounts to 25 creatures is a lot.
Yeah. Well, in the 4 Shambling Vents.
Yeah, so he has 29 creatures that can attack for damage, and none of them are bad attackers.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think that might be a little overboard going with a Tassiger in a list like this.
Yeah.
But
Tassiger is so good.
I will vouch for the card and say that it's busted.
What? Tassiger or just Delve in general? Because we've seen Gurmag Angler just take over Eternal Format.
That is pretty good.
Yeah.
Delve Commons.
Alright, so that was the Invitational. Of course, there were plenty of other decks and plenty of other people playing, so you can probably check out a lot more lists than that on the SCG site if you're interested. But we've taken up quite a bit of time with that. So, let's move into the exciting news over the last 2 days or several hours. of spoilers from Oath of the Gatewatch and some previews, it looks like, of some printings in the Shadows of Innistrad dual deck. So, first of all, I wanted to mention, I gotta find it here. There was a spoiler yesterday for the...
Yeah.
Was it yesterday or this morning for the...
World Magic Cup.
Ancient Tomb?
Yeah, that was today at the World Magic Cup.
Okay. Yeah, so it was like this morning.
Yeah. Went okay. Early as shit this morning.
So just an offhanded mention here. I shared the picture of the Ancient Tomb this morning to one of the Facebook groups for another podcast, Higher Standards, which I know the folks are there pretty well, where Jason Roskin, one of the hosts, promised one of the other listeners that it will not be standard legal. This was this morning before any other spoilers happened. You know, who knows? And so, jokingly, I had mentioned that it probably will not be standard. You know, because who knows? We could get some random weird curveball and it gets reprinted in the set itself. Since it was only spoiled in Expedition. I also highly doubt that. However, Jason Roskam placed the wager, which is great because I actually don't have to do anything for it. But he said, and I quote, "There's no probably about it. He guarantees 100% that it will not ever be printed for standard or modern play. And that he's so sure that if by some act of Satan that it does happen, that he will send me a box of Oath of the Gatewatch." So, I've been doing a lot of praying today.
of what card do we speak? If
of
I might
Ancient
ask.
Tomb.
Yeah, they're not going to print that in standard.
I know this, but
it would be
I've
gross.
Been praying.
It would be really gross.
It would be, and I can
probably... You just cast your Kozilek. Like, so, it taps for the two colors that you need.
When was the last time that they printed something? Now, hear me out here. When was the last time they printed something in standard that made 2 mana for no investment?
Never.
I don't remember a time like that.
The first time they printed Ancient Tomb?
I do believe it was Ancient Tomb.
Well, Tempest always brought... It brought along the Wasteland, too.
Yes. So, that aside, Jason said I did have to mention it in the podcast, so I did. Moving on from that, though, there was just this disgusting album of spoilers posted mere hours ago at the time of recording, leading with an Urza's Rage from an old dual deck. I don't know why that's this in this
era. Yeah, that was a little weird. I don't know. It struck me as odd, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, I'm on just the Imgur album. I don't know about you guys.
Yep, I'm on the same one.
Okay, so the first, it's like almost all the Expeditions, or a good chunk anyway.
I think it's like 18 or 19 of them.
And they're photographed.
Check out my Urza's Rage, guys.
You know what?
So pretty.
I'm done with you.
So pretty.
The first one listed is Corehaven, which, you know, I mean, that makes sense, being spoiled as an Expedition.
Now, believe it or not, that is a card I could actually see being printed in the current set.
And, I mean, it doesn't seem overpowered by any stretch of the imagination. It's a legendary land. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I could totally see that. Completely reasonable. For those of you who don't know, Corehaven, legendary land, you can tap it, add a colorless to your mana pool with the fancy new colorless symbol. And then for one and a white and you tap the land, you can prevent all combat damage that would be dealt by target attacking creature this turn. I don't want that to be standard legal, but that's because I play a Tarka Red.
It's a legendary land, though. You can only play at most two of them.
Great, but yeah. If it's out on the field and I become immense...
Yeah. But I still have to have three lands to do it, though.
Right,
it's not as good as people want it to be. It would be good. It would be good. It would not be perfect.
It would definitely be played, I think.
Yeah.
So, the next one, then, would be Tectonic Edge, which, for those of you who don't know, tap, add a colorless to the mana pool. For one colorless, tap it. Sacrifice Tectonic Edge, or I should say, never mind, scratch that, one generic mana.
Ooh, well played.
Tap it, sacrifice Tectonic Edge, destroy target non-basic land, activate this ability only if an opponent controls four or more lands. So we get some Expedition land destruction, that seems pretty good, right? Yeah.
So I anticipate this probably being, of the colorless Expedition cycle, that being the second most sought after card, maybe third most sought after card.
And the art on it is pretty freaking cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, the art is
just beautiful.
Yeah, that is the second Tectonic Edge art that has been insanely good. The promo, the FNM promo Tech Edge is also beautiful, but this one trumps that hands down.
And then, so the next one, which was officially confirmed earlier in the day, is the Forbidden Orchard, which is out of Kamigawa Block?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Tap, add one mana of any color to your mana pool. Whenever you tap it for mana, target opponent puts a 1/1 colorless spirit creature token on.
Yeah, it doesn't see play a lot of places outside of EDH, but the one... Well, I shouldn't say that. I should say it doesn't see a lot of play outside of Vintage, but it sees a lot of Vintage play. It's a very, very important part of Oath of Druids. Basically, on your turn, you tap your mana to play Oath of Druids, put a token into play, and then on your opponent's turn... you do it on your opponent's turn because you don't want them to trigger... No, it doesn't work that way. So if you have more cards, or if your opponent has more creatures in play than you, and you have an Oath of Druids in play, it lets you search your library for a creature card. Or I believe you reveal cards from the top of your library until you hit a creature card, and then you put that creature into play, and the rest goes into your graveyard. So basically this is kind of the way to cheat that. You put a creature into play under your opponent's control, you get a probably Gristlebrand, and... they get a 1/1 spirit token. That doesn't fly.
Yeah, it doesn't fly.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
All right. Yeah.
So, next on the spoilers, we have Graving Cairns, which is a filter land of the red-black variety.
Oh, yeah.
Some interesting art. I think it's pretty cool. Okay, and then, here, what I'm guessing Mike was saying would be the number one sought after.
Oh, absolutely.
Wasteland.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This will be one of the most sought-after promos of all time.
Yep. Easily. If you open a Wasteland, you keep it.
If you open a Wasteland, you don't show it to anyone.
Oh, yeah.
You put it
what if you're in draft?
In your bag
you're just
and
like,
you walk
around.
No, you set it down in front of you and don't make a sound. And then if anybody asks at the end of the tournament if an expedition was opened, you say nope.
And then you know
and
the fuck
then you there. And then you go make $1,000 off of it.
Yep.
Just to throw this out there here. So for those of you who don't know, Wasteland is a land that says tap to add colorless mana to your mana pool, and you can tap itself, sacrifice Wasteland, destroy a non-basic land. Now, this doesn't see play anywhere outside of Legacy and Vintage, and I believe it's restricted in... No, excuse me, Strip Mine is restricted in Vintage, and I think Wasteland might be as well, but I could be wrong. So it's just... it's just an insanely good card. It's played in lots of different decks. Everything in Legacy plays non-basic lands. You can mana screw your opponent. You can color screw your opponent. And in Legacy, when people are playing three color decks, two and three color decks, and not a whole lot of basics, this card is just strip mine. Like that's basically what it is.
Yeah.
So to put it in perspective, the original Wasteland promo, which was, I believe, a player rewards promo, is the exact same art as the original, and it retails. Now, obviously, this isn't what people pay for it, but it retails at about $300. The Judge promo foil that was printed in, like, 2010 is worth about $225. If you look at prices of, like, Polluted Delta versus the like a foil Polluted Delta is $100, an Expedition Polluted Delta is $250. So that is a 150% increase. Am I right? Is my math correct there?
I don't do math. I was an English
major. Yeah, I don't either. But so if you take the most recent promo, Wasteland promo, and do 150% increase on it, it retails at $800.
Good lord. Now here's the thing. Do you think there's any chance at all that it's actually printed in a...
I think, to be fair, I think it has a higher chance of being printed than a Soul Land does, so like Ancient Tomb or City of Traders. And I know people are gonna hear that and say, you're out of your fucking mind. But I think it's reasonable to do this because the land, the decks that are going to play this land, now, they probably aren't going to do it, just to clarify, because it would send Legacy players into an uproar. But
who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
I don't either, but hear me out here. So if they print this card in Standard, there is a very real penalty to playing this card. There's a very real cost. Now, yes, you can play four of them, and yes, it is really good against decks that are three or more colors. However, if you are one of those decks that's three or more colors, you can play around this card. Like, it is doable to play around a Wasteland. People do it in Legacy all the time. And it brings a lot of skill into the game, which is something that Magic wants to do. You can't just, oh, well, I'm going to wasteland your creature, or wasteland your land, or wasteland this. You'll see a lot of times in Legacy, people will play their wasteland, and they'll just tap it for colorless mana and play a card. And then their opponent will play a wasteland and wasteland their wasteland. Well, that seems odd, because neither of you got ahead in that trade. But it keeps you from later on losing a land. But the reason I think this has a higher chance of seeing play in Standard is because it doesn't do anything just flat-out broken. Now, there are lots of reasons why I can tell you it won't get printed in Standard, because this card does not want to see play in Modern. Being able to, like, they are fine with Tech Edge in Modern, which is very, very highly evidenced by the fact that the next land destruction land that they created was Encroaching Waste, which is garbage. They are totally fine with not printing Wasteland in Standard. They are totally okay with it because they don't want it to be in Modern, and they don't want to piss off Legacy players, even though they say they don't care. They are still customers, and they don't want to do that to them.
Right.
But I think it has a much higher chance of seeing play, of seeing print in Standard, because it doesn't break the fast mana rule like Soul Lands. So while I don't think this is going to see Standard print, and I almost 100% guarantee that it won't see Standard print, it has a higher chance, meaning like 0.5%, of getting printed, whereas there is absolutely no chance they will print Soul Lands.
Fair enough. All right, so the next one I want your guys' opinion on, too, is the Expedition printing of Mana Confluent. What do we think of this?
I like the art.
Well, yeah, I mean, the art on the Expeditions is undisputably good.
I don't actually like this. I know it's probably kind of selfish, but I don't see, like, it doesn't fit the theme of the other lands that they're printing. Like, you could say that Forbidden Orchard is there, and Mana Confluence is there, but the thing is, there's no other gold lands. There's multicolored lands, and there's colorless lands, but there's no other gold lands. And as far as I can tell, there are no, there's no other all-colored slots in the set. And I believe there's only one Expedition slot that hasn't been spoken for at this point. So if that's the case, I really dislike just throwing two gold lands in if you're not going to do, like, a cycle of five. Like, you could do Forbidden Orchard, Mana Confluence, Command Tower, which would make Wizards a shitload of money.
Oh, yeah.
What did I say? Mana Confluence, Forbidden Orchard, Command Tower, Caves of, what is the...
Cavern of Souls?
Well, you could do Cavern of Souls, although I'm not a huge fan on that one. Gemstone Mine, sorry, and City of Grass. Gemstone Mine and City Brass. Then you have five gold lands that all have a pseudo drawback, except for Command Tower. But Command Tower will never see play in a Standard format, so it doesn't matter. It's an Expedition. And it would kind of cater towards EDH players, which you're already very obviously doing in this set with Wastes. It's not that I don't think the card is a valid card to print as an Expedition, because I think it's fine. But if you're going to do just two gold lands, make them synergize somehow. Don't just say, well, they both make any color of mana. Let's do that. I would like to see something like Mana Confluence and City of Brass, or Forbidden Orchard and Command Tower, where they both do the exact same thing. Or, hell, even do, like, a bad cycle of Expedition lands. They don't have to be premium cards. Do, like... there are two cards that both say when this card comes into play, it comes into play tapped and pay one or sacrifice it.
Rupture Spire,
and then there's one from Return to Ravnica too.
Transguild Promenade.
Yeah, Like, oh. just print those two. Yeah, they're not the highlight cards of the 20 cards you're putting in, but...
Reflecting Pool.
Reflecting Pool. That would be the one that I would put with Command Tower. Fair. Like, it's not... Again, it's not that I don't think it fits, but I think it would have been... It could have fit better.
Yeah. Fair enough. Okay, so next up we have Rugged Prairie, which is Red-White Filterland.
Yep.
That's Twilight Mire, which is Green-Black Filter. Fetid Heath is White-Black Filter.
Just want to point out really quick here, that Fetid Heath looks amazing.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Pretty sweet, like, art. Check amazing. It out, listeners. Since I can't show it.
True.
Eye of Ugin. Are Tron players going to go out of their way to get next?
Oh, yeah. Ugin?
Absolutely. The card is a one-of in most decks. In all Tron decks, it's a one-of. So, yeah, I can definitely see this being a high-quality card for people to pick up. The only thing I dislike about it is it's been printed, what, five times in the last 5 years? So,
all right.
It's a little overdone.
Yeah,
but.
I can see that. Firelit Thicket, which is green-red filter land. Strip Mine.
Yeah, Strip Mine looks real cool. I don't think this one will be very high on the list of valuable cards. You'll find it high on the list of, like, EDH players and stuff like that, but I don't think, like, straight up value-wise, you will see a lot of people, like, scrounging for this card. Now, having said that, I don't believe there is more than a single foil printing of this card. And it's from the vault, so I could be wrong. Black bordered antiquities versions of this card, depending on the art, run anywhere from $10 to $20. So I could be wrong. If this could be a $150-$200 expedition, but I don't see that happening.
That's fair. Next we have Wooded Bastard, Bastion, green white filter land.
The art on this filter land is beautiful.
Yeah, man. Oh my god. Sorry, I just saw the next expedition and I didn't realize. I thought it was the green white filter land.
Nope. And we have Horizon Canopy.
Oh,
now,
that's one that's gonna fucking skyrocket. Yeah,
that one, but like, out of all the ones that have been spoiled, like, if I saw Horizon Canopy and then Grove the Burn Willows, I'll be like, okay. They're doing the future site kind of lands, you know, well, like the two most sought after, but we don't see a Grove of the Burn Willows.
Agreed, but keep in mind there's still one slot open.
Yeah, this is true.
One that we haven't seen, so.
But I was talking to Josh Harry, and I don't know, it just seems kind of like if they're gonna do these sets, like, for expeditions, like, you know, they're gonna do all the they're doing the filter land. Okay. That's good. That's a set.
Yeah.
But like, then you just have Horizon Canopy out of nowhere, which I'm not arguing because the art is beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's just beautiful.
Super simple, but really, really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about printing cards like Horizon Canopy and Grove of the Burn Willows at the same time. Now, I do believe that both of them need a standard reprint because the price needs to come down. However, I'm skeptical of printing them without finishing the cycle.
Yeah, and that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, it makes no sense. Like, they specifically created these cards so that in the future you can finish the cycle and have it be like, oh, check it out, guys, this is the completion of what we had in future site, and people will connect with that, and it'll hopefully bring players back to the game or things like that. So I get it, but it just doesn't fit that they would print it here. Although this is about the most excusable place to put it, except maybe from the vault.
Like about a month and a half ago, traded for 3 Horizon Canopies. Carson, the guy who I traded with, he said, "Man, I'm gonna laugh if they reprint it in standard." So in a way, I wish it would get reprinted in a set, like, maybe from the vault, so that there's more out there, and, I mean, it's still legal and modern.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, I just traded away so much, and if they reprint it in standard, it's just going to plummet.
You sound like a legacy player.
I'm going to magic, man.
I know.
Alright. Next up, we have Cascade Bluffs, which is the blue-red filter land, Sunken Ruins, which is blue-black.
Best land on this list.
Yeah, I know Mike's... I mean, I love the art. I think Delver is just gorgeous.
To be fair, we're talking about specific art, but the art on all of these cards is insanely good.
Mm-hmm.
I will not say that any of them look bad by any stretch.
Let's see. We have Ancient Tomb, which we talked about.
We missed the other good one.
Sunken Ruin.
I said that one. You guys were talking over me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Amateurs. Sunken Ruins. Blue-black. Joker Land. Ancient Tomb. What?
There's jellyfish in it.
You're awesome. A jellyfish.
You're a jellyfish.
All right, Dust Bowl, more fish land destruction. That seems to be the cycle here, is land destruction.
Oh, yeah.
So I can dig it.
Dust Bowl's not bad.
Wasteland again.
Some odd reason, it's in here twice.
Okay.
And then we've got...
Hold on. It's called Seagate Ruins.
Just
trust me, it's called Seagate Ruins.
Okay,
it's,
what does it do, Mr. Frenchman?
It taps and makes colorless mana, and you can pay 2 and a colorless, specifically a colorless, 2 generic and a colorless, to tap it and draw a card, but you can only activate this ability if you have no cards in your hand.
Interesting. I should mention, before we move on, that this is the first card that we're talking about that is not X-Men.
Yep, this is going to be printed in Standard.
So, and this looks to be a French, maybe...
Pre-release promo.
So
for those of you who are unaware, and I don't know if everybody knows this, but if you're looking at a newer card, so Magic Origins, is it Magic Origins where they started the new border?
No, it was M15.
M15 or forward. If you look at the bottom left corner of the card, it will tell you the printing of the card like it always has, what number set out of how many it is, with the rarity next to it, and then... underneath that, it will tell you the set with the set abbreviation. So for this one, it says OGW, Oath of the Gatewatch. If it's foil, it will have a star. If it's not foil, it will have a little dot. And then next to that, it will tell you what language it's in. It will say FR for French, EN for English, SP for Spanish, JP for Japanese, CS for Chinese. So for those of you who were unaware, it's a super simple thing, but a lot of people don't even know it's there.
Well... and to be fair, my monitor's not
great. Oh, you're fine.
So I can't.
You're fine.
I know. So that's, different. There might see some kind of cycle of land similar to that.
And just to clarify, this is a rare land, which is a little bit odd for colorless lands, but it kind of makes sense in a set like this, obviously.
Yeah, and it also shows, Seagate destroyed, if you're into the storyline. So, that's a thing. Alright, next one is Holdout Settlement, which is a common land. Adds colorless to your mana pool. You can tap it, and then you tap an untapped creature you control to add 1 mana of any color to your... So, interesting creature-land synergy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
I think it's not going to see any play. Now, admittedly, we could end up seeing a bunch of, like, 0 or 1 cost colorless creatures that don't have any power, or it synergizes very well with, like, Eldrazi tokens.
Yeah.
So that is definitely a thing to keep in mind when you're looking at cards as they come out. So if there's ever anything that costs 1, regardless of how bad it is, if it makes an Eldrazi token... keep that card in your thoughts, because it's effectively going to be an Elvish Mystic.
Yep, and, this, will come in handy a lot for Limited, I think. Same with the next card, which is a reprint of Unknown Shores, which I don't know how common that card, I've seen it printed in Theros.
There's been a bunch of different types of cards that do this exact same thing.
Yes, it's a functional reprint of, every other common land.
Shimmering Grotto, I want to say, what the older versions are called. And so
this one you tap, it adds a colorless to your mana pool, and then for 1 generic and you tap it, you can add 1 mana of any color. So it's like a mini filter land.
Yeah, I think a card like this, as 2 colored and colorless based as the format appears to be, as far as Limited goes, this card is going to be insanely good.
Yeah.
This is going to be the colorless land that you want to draft, because it lets you play your colorless cards, lets you fix your mana early, and then in the late game it also lets you play cards like Kozilek that you get without having to shoehorn a flat-out colorless land into your deck.
Right. And then so next is a couple copies of Foil Wastes, which are just the new basic land.
Now, the first one is pretty, but that second one
is absolutely
gorgeous.
As a foil, it is.
Yeah, it's insanely good looking.
Like, I feel like these foil waste cards, EDH players that are going to want to play colorless, they're going to want the foils.
Mm-hmm.
These might be, like, really expensive foils.
I don't know about that. Yeah. They're going to be in the common slot.
This is true. But yeah. They're still pretty, though.
So are the four basics. So are four Zendikar basics. But, again, those have since dropped in price since they got printed again in standard as full art. So.
Right. Okay, so then next is Crumbling Vestige, another common land. Enters the battlefield tapped. When it enters the battlefield, add one mana of any color to your mana pool. And then its tap ability just adds a colorless to your mana. But I'd like to note on this card is the first instance I think I've seen, unless I might not be paying attention. Yes, I have not been paying attention. The reminder text of what the new colorless symbol means.
Yeah, a couple of the... Actually, I think all of the colorless lands have reminder text on them.
Yes.
Or will, rather.
I think you may be right. The next card is in Russian.
Hold on. I know what it is, I think. Tap to add colorless, pay one more. Okay, hold on. It is called Corrupted Crossroads. And I'm actually, both of the last two cards, this one and the one before it, are cards that I'm super interested to mess around with. It's another rare land. Corrupted Crossroads. You can tap it to add colorless mana to your mana pool, or you can tap it and pay one life and add one mana of any color to your mana pool. However, you can only spend this mana to cast Devoid spells.
Ooh.
Yeah, so it gives you... This is another one that you're like, oh, well, I don't want to see a land in a rare slot, but if I get this and Devoid is a thing, which I'm assuming it will be, otherwise there wouldn't be so many instances of Devoid on lands, I think this will be a good one to draft. Like, it's not something you're excited with taking first pick, so there are going to be a lot of drafts where people just get this in their opening pack and they're like, well, shit. But I think it does have a lot of applications. You can make colorless mana, so it's not a dead card ever, but it's also, it makes colorless mana for your Devoid spells too, so.
Neat.
It will have upside.
Go ahead.
No, it'll have upside. It'll definitely have an upside.
Good deal. The next one is the first of an uncommon cycle of land, it looks like. Landes Descendres. We're in French again. Looks like it just enters the battlefield tapped.
Yep.
And taps for black or red.
Yep, Ashenmoor. Or what they are calling Ashenmoor. I believe Ashenmoor was the one that came into play.
Do we have the English names on these at all?
I don't think so. I think some of them are spoiled, but some of them are just...
Yeah.
Salvation, it says, like, green, red, red, green, tap land.
Oh.
Blue, black, tap land.
Bastards.
The next one,
white, blue.
Mandelstrom.
Mandelstrom.
Der Mandelstrom kommt getarnt ins Spiel. Erhole deinen Mana Vorrat Weiß oder Blau.
Weiß oder Blau?
Yeah.
It's a blue, white tap land.
Yeah. But it's a German one, and so it's pretty.
If you can read the one that's in Cyrillic, I'll clap for you.
Oh hell no, I can't read that.
But
it's very. But that art is pretty. Like all these arts on these tap lands are like pretty good.
All right. All the tap lands are done by Jeff Cliff Childs. So.
Oh okay.
All right. Next one of interest is what looks to be the red white man land. Yep. Googly Spillo.
This is an Italian. Liguria Aspello, entrapa nel campo di battaglia, tapate!
Spicy meatball!
Spicy meatball!
Oh my lord.
So it taps for red or white, comes in tap. For two red and a white, turns into a 2-1 Rosa e Bianca Condopio.
A 2-1 elemental with double strike.
Yep, 2-1 red white with double strike, yep.
So kind of what most people I think were expecting.
Yep. If the red-blue one is bad, I'm going to flip the fuck out on people.
All right, let's see. We're back to the uncommons then again. Blue-white, tap land, green
now, here's
white.
Here's a spicy meatball.
The Sphinx?
Of the final word.
Sphinx of the final word. Five colorless, two blue, mythic rare, can't be countered, flying, hexproof. Instant and sorcery spells you control can't be countered by spells or ability. A 5/5, what do we do with it?
All-time limited bomb.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it's standard junk and limited bomb.
If it costs six, it would be insane.
Yeah, I could see that.
But it's not.
Yep.
This is one of those cards that I really, really want to be good, but it's just, I don't think it will be.
No,
really
it's all about that green-blue ramp turbo turn.
What would make this card, like, what would have to happen for this card to see standard play?
Four blue and blue.
That's definitely a start.
You would also
have to have cards like Ojutai and Dragon Lord Silengar not exist, because they do essentially the same thing. I mean, obviously they don't, they can be countered, and your instants and sorceries can be countered when you resolve those cards. However, they're just flat out better. Like, when you can play Ojutai and the game turns from a control matchup against a tempo matchup to, I have an Ojutai, you have to kill it. This card doesn't do that.
Yeah.
It changes the scope of the game, and Sphinx of the Final Word doesn't do that, at least not in the current format. So in the future, I could see it seeing play. Like, if Innistrad comes out and we see a bunch more slower decks, whether they be mid-range or control, and aggro kind of gets pushed to the wayside for one more set, like, we're in the weird uptick of control decks again. After Sphinx's Revelation rotated, everything kind of took a nosedive for control decks. And not for, like, I'm unhappy about it, but I understand that you kind of have to have that ebb and flow where some decks are better at some points and other decks are better at other points, because if you didn't, everybody would just play the same deck and it would get horrible. But we're in an uptick in control decks or tempo decks or spell-based decks. And that's a good thing for a card like this, because that means we might have already peaked, but it's possible that we'll keep going in that direction. So,
very cool. Next one is one of the first ones they spoiled officially. Yep. It's Crush of Tentacles. Four blue-blue, return all non-land permanents to their owner's hands, but it's also got a surge cost, which is three blue and a blue, and surge means that you may cast a spell for its surge cost if you or a teammate has cast another spell this turn, and if you cast it for its surge cost, you put an 8/8 blue octopus creature token onto the battlefield after all the everything else went away.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
It's definitely good.
Yeah, it is.
So I got into an argument with some friends of mine over this card. on Facebook, in public view of everyone. But, like, my argument was, this card is not that good. And no one waited for me to explain my reasoning, nor allowed me to explain my reasoning. So everybody was just like, you're crazy. You're an idiot. Don't talk. But seriously, now in Two-Headed Giant, don't get me wrong, the card's fucking bonkers.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you can cast this, even if you're bouncing every single thing that your opponent has put into play over the last five turns, your opponent casts a spell that does something to kill one of your opponent's creatures, and you make an 8/8 on an empty board. That's really good, like really, really good. Now, in competitive standard, this card is not that good. Now, everybody's like, well, you didn't play with Cyclonic Rift. And I was like, bullshit, I didn't play with Cyclonic Rift. I played the shit out of that card. Cyclonic Rift cost two. People are completely ignoring the fact that Cyclonic Rift cost two. It's really good when you cast it for seven. However, 90% of the time, you didn't cast it for seven. You cast it for two. When you're putting a fucking six mana sorcery in your deck, you had damn well better be sure that the card's going to win the game for you. You don't put a six mana sorcery in your deck if it's not going to do anything for you. And if you are casting this for its surge cost, what one mana spell in standard are you playing that is going to allow you to, with value, put an 8/8 into play on an empty board? Are you going to cast Despise on your opponent's empty hand and then bounce all of the cards that you would take with Despise to their hand and then make an 8/8 octopus? No, that's stupid. That is completely stupid.
Clearly,
you don't do things
they're going
like that.
To reprint Quicken.
Yes.
Well, that would be disgusting.
Quicken, Surge, go.
Six mana draw a card, bounce all your shit, and get an 8/8. That's
crazy. Wouldn't that just that be disgusting? Be
And you can do it on your opponent's end step? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That would be...
modern, man. I'm playing this in modern.
Ugh.
All right.
I think the card is good. I just don't think it is anywhere near as powerful as everybody is.
I agree with you completely.
Let's get in in Chandra the Flamecaller.
Yes.
Which has got me excited to play a red Planeswalker.
Yes, and that's important all on its own.
So, I'll sit over here and not talk for a while, because I have differing opinions about this card.
Okay, so Chandra Flamecaller, 4 colorless, 2 red. Okay, that's a red flag. Ha, pun intended. Starts with 4 loyalty, plus 1, put 2 3-1 red elemental creature tokens with haste onto the battlefield. Exile them at the beginning of the next end step. 0, discard all the cards in your hand, then draw that many cards plus 1, or minus X, deals X damage to each creature. Okay, so these are like all of the most red abilities that exist, just jammed into one planes.
Yeah, absolutely true.
And that's awesome. I mean, like, 6 mana is not great, but, you know, being able to get 2 3-1s with haste, going at it, discarding your hand, drawing more cards. I mean, it's not the best Planeswalker ever printed, but someone's going to do stuff with it.
Yeah. I just like that, if you are in such a bad situation where, I mean, we're just thinking about Siege Rhinos rotated, so you can just minus 4 Chandra and wipe the board for 6 mana, which...
Maybe.
It's bad, but, I mean, there might be some situations where there is, like, some sort of, like, Grixis control that plays, like, a 1 of Chandra just to, like, 0, discard, like, 3 lands, draw 4 cards, or I need a plus, or, like, you just... It's just kind of a... I don't know. It's weird, but I like it.
It's weird, but I like it.
I just don't know, like... I just don't know what it would go with.
So, I would see, as it stands, without knowing any other cards in Oath, this deck would, like you said, I think, be in some kind of Grixis, maybe, but I don't like the double red in that. So, honestly, more like a black red, like we saw earlier, or kind of a big red strategy, might work better, hopefully, with Chandra being more represented in the set. We'll get some decent burn spells, too. So that might let mono-red be more of a thing again, and even have a higher curve. So we'll see, I guess. I don't know. It's tough to fit right now without knowing every other card in this.
Yeah. I to be completely honest, I dislike this card. Like, it's not that I think it doesn't have a place. I just dislike this card. But, having said that, I think if Big Red becomes the deck again, and I know neither of you guys played the last time big red decks were a thing, versus, like, red beatdown decks, but if Big Red becomes a thing, that is a place where I think this card could be very good. So when I look at Planeswalkers, the first two things that I look at are, what does this loyalty start at in relation to what I'm paying to put it into play, versus... does it protect itself? And neither of those things on this card are good value. Now, if it put, like, a single 3-1 red elemental into play, and it didn't exile at the beginning of the next end step, I think that would be fine. I think it would make the card infinitely better. But because it is doing what red does, it's super aggressive, I don't think that ability stacks up quite as well as I want to. Now, don't get me wrong, 6 damage for 6 mana is a pretty good investment, but it's creatures that you have to attack through other things with on turn 6 or further, so it's not guaranteed damage. So I don't like ability 1 as it's written. I think it could be really good in a big red deck, and that's the one ability I'm looking at going, yeah, that's going to be real good if something it can be played in pops up. The second ability, it is very red, but if I wanted to play Wheel of Fortune, I'm damn sure not paying 6 mana for it. I didn't want to pay 5 mana for it when Reforged the Soul was the standard, and that cost 2 most of the time. So it's one of those things where you're just paying way too much for what it does. Now, don't get me wrong, there are decks that would want this, and the first thing, like, I didn't even look at the mana cost when I read this card first, and I was just like, discard cards in your hand, then draw that many cards plus 1. And I went, Jesus, mono red, are you kidding me? Discard 3 cards, get 4 new cards? Like, you just pitched 3 lands and now you have 4 spells. That's gross.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the mana cost and I was like, oh, okay, well.
Never mind.
Yeah. And the ult is fine. Like, you can use it immediately, so it's not horrible. But I just don't think it's a card. So, to me, Planeswalkers need to be able to stand on their own to be good. And this one doesn't really do that. Like, you're either going to use it as a a windfall type effect where you discard a bunch of cards, draw some more, and it dies next turn. You're going to use it as a beat stick that doesn't necessarily get two damage, or you can use it as a board wipe. And none of those things I want to pay 6 mana for.
Yep, I think that's fair. I mean, it's not the greatest card ever. I think it's exciting to have a, you know...
Oh, absolutely. I love that Chandra's back. Love that Chandra's back. And she's doing Chandra things again.
Yep. Alright, so next in line is the other Planeswalker spoiled. Oh, was Nissa, Voice of Zendikar, color of green. +1, put an 0/1 green plant creature token onto the battlefield. -2, put a +1/+1 counter on each of you control. And -7, you gain X life and draw X cards where X is the number of lands you control.
Now, I think this card is bonkers.
Eldrazi Ramp, anybody?
Yeah.
You just start printing these 0/1s. That are gonna just be chump blockers, and then you get to a point in the game where you cast your Ulamog or you play your Ugin.
Yep.
And you it would suck to minus an Ugin and get rid of your Nissa, but you wouldn't have to do that. You could plus and bolt something, and then you can make an 0/1 plant, and it would block the other thing.
Yep.
And then you get to a point where you -7, and let's say you've been ramping this entire game. Let's just say you have 13 lands. I'm going to gain 13 life and draw 13 cards. That's insane.
So this card... go ahead.
So one thing I noticed about both the Planeswalkers, how they both make... And while mm-hmm. I know that within, the color restrictions, they can both do that just fine in the ways that they do, I just think it's interesting that that's what they decided to go with.
I think it's flavorful. It's definitely flavorful. Chandra has never made elementals before, to my knowledge. She had a Phoenix.
Yeah, that too.
But her making elementals is a new thing, so that's... I feel like that, or I hope that ties into the story a little bit. So, now, having said that, to go back to, what I was talking about with stuff protecting itself, I think this is a very good example of a card that protects itself very well. A Planeswalker that protects itself very well. So the two things you look at is, does it protect itself, and what do you get out of it for the mana cost? So it's a 3-mana Planeswalker that starts at 4, essentially, and it protects itself. And its other abilities are not so good that they are broken, and they're not bad enough that they don't do anything. So, I'm okay with paying 3 mana and putting a 1/1 counter on 2 creatures, maybe 3 creatures. I'm totally fine with that. I'm also okay with paying 3 mana to put a plant into play after I have 2 creatures that now protects my Planeswalker. Next turn I can put a bunch of counters on my creatures, and you do that twice in a row and you have a very good team. Might put them out of Languish range or something like that. So
yeah, and looking at this, all I can think is Green-White Megamorph.
Oh, absolutely.
And, Hangerback Walker?
Yeah, I was actually going to say Hardened Scales with this card is nuts. Oh. For 1 Hardened Scales, turn 2 Hangerback, it's a 2-2. Turn 3 Nissa, -2, it's a 4-4. It's a 4-4 Hangerback. It's nuts! That's, godly, and that's if they don't, I guess they can't complete disregard it, because...
Well, it would be a 2-2.
Yeah, it'd be a 2-2. So they could. So that's if they have it, and if they're on the play.
Dreams like I'm a spell slinger.
But this is like Magic Christmas Land. When I first saw this card, I'm put a 1/1 counter, and then I was going through some old cards, and I saw Hardened Scales, and I looked at this card, and I put it next to each other. I'm holy crap, this is nuts.
I love it.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the Planeswalkers. Now we're moving on to some really interesting things that really... shouldn't be out.
Oh, absolutely.
But they're
already not. It seems to me like a pissed off Wizards employee.
Something like that. So the first one is a, let's see, what is it? Korean? I can't read the...
It is Japanese.
Okay, I see it. JP. Geist of St. Draft.
Yep.
I didn't look at it very carefully when I was scrolling past it, and...
Neither did I. I thought it was a new card.
Yeah, and it's new art. 1 white, blue, of course. It's Geist of St. Draft. But, of course, it's in Japanese, so I didn't really read it. But it's literally what it is. Dual deck reprint. That does not mean it's in the next Innistrad set. I honestly wouldn't be surprised if it's not.
Oh, no. I highly doubt it.
Especially because the next card is a new card that I haven't looked at a translation of, but I'm pretty sure.
I haven't found
card.
A translation of it yet.
So. And it's a big demon dude, and I'm...
It's a 4-mana 4/5.
It's 4 mana 4/5 with some amount of text.
So from the little bit I don't know Japanese, so I won't lie about that. But from cards that I own that are also in Japanese, this has a keyword on it. The second ability on this card is a keyword ability because it has the keyword symbols or the symbols that denote keyword and a dash. And then there are numbers in the bottom half of that text box. So I feel like it could be something like Morbid or something along those lines. Undying, maybe, if it's a reprint and not a... what am I trying to say? Gosh, my brain's not working. If it's a reprint and not a new card. But as far as I know, it'll probably pop up tomorrow. But as far as I know, there's not a translation of that card floating around yet. So
yeah, we'll have to look into that and get back to you as we find out. But since that is a new card and it's the dual deck logo, chances are Geist of St. Traft is not in the next.
Yes. So Geist is probably the reprint that's showing up, and then whatever this demon is the new card. However, I'm super sick of seeing 4-mana 4/5s. I'm so sick of seeing 4-mana 4/5s. And now we have one that flies.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's a red card.
So now we're back to Oath of the Gatewatch cards, because this was apparently uploaded with no regard for podcaster.
None.
Kozilek's Return is 2 colorless and a red, 2 generic and a red. Devoid, it deals 2 damage to each creature. Whenever you cast an Eldrazi creature spell with converted mana cost 7 or greater, you may exile it from your graveyard. If you do, Kozilek's Return deals 5 damage to each creature.
I just want to say now, this card is insane.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It is a... counterable, colorless Pyroclasm for 1 more mana at instant speed that then lets you... Jesus, is there almost Wildfire your opponent? Like, it's better than Wildfire, essentially, when you cast a Giant Beater. So it basically says, okay, well, in the early game, I'm going to wipe your board so that you can't kill me. And then when I get to 7 mana, I'm going to cast this for 5 and kill all your dudes before my Giant Beater comes into play. And, sorry, but now you have nothing.
Yeah.
I looked at this card and I read it as a mythic and I went like the I did I said Kozilek's Return deals 2 damage to each creature. Whenever you cast an Eldrazi creature spell with converted mana cost 7 or greater, and then I just stopped because I assumed that what it was going to say is return this card from your graveyard to your hand. I just assumed that that's what it was going to say. And when I reread it, I went, oh my god.
Nuts.
I do dislike that it's in the mythic slot. However, it is a mythic level spell.
Definitely.
And it's not so game shattering overpowered that it is a mythic tag because it's going to be that good, but it will be a very good card, and that's why it's in the mythic slot.
And I think especially for you don't want this card showing up frequently.
Oh god, no. Yeah, and it's a storyline card too. It highlights a huge part of the storyline, which is one of the reasons Wizards originally created the mythic rarity, was to use unique cards and cards that highlight the story.
Yep.
It's evolved into just being the most powerful cards most of the time, but this kind of harkens back to what they created it for.
Alright, and then the next card is Worldbreaker. 6 generic and a green. Mythic, Eldrazi, Devoid. When you cast this, exile target artifact, enchantment, or land. It has reach. For 2 generic and a colorless, sacrifice a land, return it from your graveyard to your hand, and it's a 5/7.
Yeah.
It's just a huge acidic slime, but it exiles, so that's kind of important.
Well, I don't know.
It's more costing. It's 2 more, but it's only a green and 6 colors instead of, like, 2 green and 3 colorless.
Yeah.
And also coming back.
Yeah, this is a very good card.
It also has reach.
Yeah, that's the thing that stands out to me. I'm like...
just swats things out of the air.
Now that I'm playing Esper Dragons again, I guess it looks like I'm going to have to be playing more than 2 Utterands if this card catches on as a special card, because there's no other way to beat this card.
Yep.
Yeah, this... I mean, like, obviously a very strong card, but definitely being 7 mana to cast will hold it back.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to be facing it, honestly.
No.
A 5/7 is a big deal. So, and then exiling your land isn't great either.
No, not at all. Like, cards that say exile target artifact, enchantment, or land, 9 times out of 10, they exile a land.
Yep.
Now, the fact that they can hit enchantments and artifacts is awesome for that card or the player who's playing that card. But most of the time, it's going to be like, oh, well, I'm on 7 mana and you're on 7 mana. Or I'm on 6 mana and you're on 6 mana. You pass the turn to me. I play my 7th land. I play Worldbreaker. Now you're 2 turns behind me. Oh, you don't have a land? Man, that's brutal.
Yeah. Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah.
Alright, so then the last one in this huge album of spoilers, which, again, this is all from one source. I've yet to figure out where it's come from exactly. I saw some Twitter account that a lot of people were messaging and saying, have fun getting sued by Wizards. Mm-hmm. But I don't know the connection there. So this was a little less exciting because it's one we've had for a couple days now. Well, about a week or so. Aili, Eternal Pilgrim, it's 1 white, 1 black. Legendary creature, core cleric, has death touch. You can pay a generic, sacrifice another creature. You gain life equal to its toughness. And then for 1, a white and a black, sacrifice another creature, exile target, non-land permanent. Activate this ability only if you have at least 10 life more than your starting life total.
I actually think this card is pretty good.
I do too.
This card seems like a 2-mana, 2/3 death touch alone.
Exactly.
Is something worth noting. But then it has this huge, like, it has 2 separate abilities where it's like, oh, so I can sacrifice another creature and gain life equal to its toughness. Well, in a world full of Siege Rhino, you can gain 5 life.
Yeah.
Like,
exactly.
It's just, like, it's another outlet where, like, against a Tarka Red where, like, they're trying to kill you fast, like, you can just sack your Siege, like, you can block their big dude.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can sack it and gain 5 life, and then nullify the rest of the attack. And then its second ability is like, well, if I get 10 more life than my starting life total, I just start exiling anything I want.
Yep.
Yep, that's interesting.
I think on a card like this, you kind of have to ignore the third ability. When to me, this is sort of like a level-up creature.
Yeah.
Like, you have one ability that you always will activate, and then one that is unlocked, per se, or you level up to, or you activate, or whatever. I think this card is just good on the surface. Like, if it was, like Justin said, if it was just a 2-3 death touch for 2, I'd probably look at it a second time. But the fact that sacrifice another creature, and you gain life equal to the sacrificed creature's toughness, exists. Look at black-white cards, and then take black out of the equation, and look at the white cards that exist in the format right now. You have 3/5s and X4s and stuff like that. You have big-blooded creatures that are going to gain you a lot of life, and then you have a card like... Now, don't get me wrong. This is a really gimmicky way to win, but you legitimately have Feldar Sovereign in the format.
Yeah.
And when you're sacrificing creatures that are gaining you 5 life a turn or more than that because it only costs 1 mana, like, say I play a Siege Rhino and I attack you for 4. We pass the turn. I block with my Aili. I sacrifice my Siege Rhino. I'm now at 28 life if you haven't dealt me any damage. And I'm just going to untap and play an Archangel of Tides. So now you have to pay extra to attack me with the creatures that you don't have right now. And I'm already halfway to my goal of being at 40 life. You play a Feldar Sovereign, and they try to kill it. You just sacrifice the Feldar Sovereign, gain 6 life. And when you draw another one, you're that much closer to winning through that way. Now, I don't think that's the way you want to build the deck, because winning through having 40 life is probably not very reasonable. But being able to... Now, don't get me wrong, this card's going to absorb a lot of spot removal, but anytime your opponent has to kill one of your other creatures, and they try and do that, and you can sacrifice and get value out of that creature, it's going to be insane.
And, like, I'm looking at this thing, and I'm thinking, like, okay, this with, you know, even Jotty Offshoot is good. This might even work in the Rally decks.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just sack my Sidisi's Faithful and get 4.
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. I think it's maybe a little bit of overkill in a rally deck. However, it definitely fits. It definitely fits.
And I'm sure somebody will try it, so we'll just have to see. But, you know, okay, we've been going off this for almost 2 hours.
Okay, I want to say one thing, though. One thing I thought about. If you can play this even in, like, let's just say, like, a Mardu-esque, like, token deck, or, like, just a Mardu deck in general. Mardu Ascendancy, when you stack it, gives +0/+3. So if you are playing, like, a bunch of tokens, they suddenly, like, become big-butted creatures where you can just, like, stack your Mardu Ascendancy, stack, like, swing with my tokens, oh, they all survived, stack.
Yeah, you almost, like, just combo kill your opponent late game.
Yeah, and, like, you just gain this huge amount of life that your opponent just goes, this is going to take forever to kill you, and then maybe you untap, and, you know, like Mike said, play your Felidor Sovereign, oh, I win. Like, there's like, some really cool things that, like, when I first saw this card, I thought of, like, I was just going through, like, what this card could go in. It can go in a lot of different decks, and I saw Mardu Ascendancy, and I'm like, there could be something there.
It's possible. It's definitely possible.
Yep. Cool. Well, that's the last of the spoilers from this giant leak. I'm interested to see what happens in the aftermath of this.
Yeah.
Official spoilers start on the 28th, so we can expect to start seeing the confirmations from Wizards and a lot of these. These all seem pretty legit. I am always wary of confirmations. I will not say that any of these are confirmed until it comes out of the mouth of Wizards themselves. But they look pretty interesting and look pretty, you know, correct and out there. So, did you guys have anything you wanted to say before we signed off? Mike, go ahead.
Not really. Just, this is, like, spoilers like these, and I don't want to, again, we don't know if these are 100%. They do look legit, but we're not 100% sure. But at the same time, this is, like, stuff that comes out like this is the reason I don't like using websites like Mythic Spoiler. Now, let me say before I go in-depth on this that I think Mythic Spoiler is a fine website, and 90% of the time they are correct when they have spoilers. However, like, they don't fact-check very well. They are notorious, and apparently that is, people have ignored this fact, but they're notorious for just posting spoilers whenever they pop up. They don't fact check. If you look at the Imgur listing and then go look on MTG Salvation, they specifically state on their website that none of these are guaranteed spoilers, that we haven't source checked any of this stuff. It's just here because we have this. Well, Mythic Spoiler doesn't have any of that. It's almost like sowing disinformation without telling people that it's maybe not true. So I don't have a problem with Mythic Spoiler, but I think there are much better websites to use. That's my soapbox.
Yeah, I think you need to remember that Mythic Spoiler is literally just a gathering of images.
Yeah, exactly.
Spoiled. Like, just take it with a grain of salt. Mythic Spoiler is great because you can just see the images right there laid out in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's all they are. It's good for that. Don't take anything you see on there too seriously until December 28th, when spoilers start. Justin, any last thoughts?
I'm sort of looking forward to when fetches rotate, if that sounds weird. Like, I don't know what Oath is going to bring for rare lands, which is probably the other set of dual lands. I would like to see, like, we've been in this three-colored of, Like you can literally play whatever you want. Like, we've been kind of spoiled with the format that the standard has been ever since, like, cons came out.
Yep.
And I feel like going back to more of a, you know, you can play three colors, but you won't have all the fixing that we do. And, like, you are going to be started playing, like, these maybe mainly two color, but slightly splashing for a third strategies again, which is a good thing. But when you're coming from a format as spoiled as this is, like, let's just say you started, like, in cons and you've been playing this, like, play whatever you want format, and then you go back down, you're going to, a lot of people might just go, well, I don't want to play anymore. Like, why can't I play all the things?
Nah, I don't think it'll be that extreme. I think one of the benefits of playing a three-color format, you won't see until after that three-color format rotates. I remember distinctly watching people play who had started during Ravnica Block, the return to Ravnica Block. then go to Pharaoh Standard and have to adjust to a two-color or mono-color deck. It wasn't easy for a lot of those people, but you'll notice that the small things as far as, what lands you play and how you build your deck with one of the two of and the cards that you play in those decks becomes of a higher quality. The cards necessarily aren't better, but you'll see the way and the cards that people play improve. Their skill has improved because playing a three-color format is not just simple. You have to know what to fetch for and when to do this and when to have a particular land type and stuff like that. So they focus on things like that, and it makes them better at the minute things that you don't necessarily think of when you're just, oh, I have an island on turn one and a plains on turn two, and now have my mana is fixed.
And so here's the thing I find interesting about every spoiler we've seen so far today. The lack of expedition battle land.
Mm-hmm.
Points very heavily to the fact that there will not be the other five new dual lands, quote unquote.
Yeah, and I'm a little surprised about that.
I am surprised as well, but it makes sense with the fact that we will be having fetch lands, and if they printed those, oh my god, mana would be perfect.
Yes, it would.
It would be disgusting. So it makes sense. So I'm willing to bet we will see them very soon.
Likely what's going to happen is we're going to get the battle lands as we have them already, and we're not going to get new colored lands. We're going to get, like, filter lands. Because filter lands have not been printed in a standard legal set. Graven Cairns got printed. No. I take that back. They did print them in a standard legal set. They printed them in Shadowmoor and Eventide. But that's a card that they've been wanting and have been talking about reprinting. And it goes with, because there's 10 of them, it goes with the five-color format. So I would not be surprised to see those. And then we have allied colors of one set of duels, enemy colors of one set of duels, so like man lands and battle lands. And then in Innistrad, we'll get check lands that check to see, like Sulphur Falls and Isolated Chapel and stuff like that. But they will be new ones, hopefully, or we'll get tri-lands. Well, we won't get tri-lands. Tap lands, maybe. Something like that. So, we'll see. I don't know. There's lots of ways they could go. I don't anticipate the filter lands being printed in standard, but it's a possibility.
Yeah, cool stuff. Well, thanks again for joining us. You can follow me on Twitter at NerdMeat, Justin on Twitter at JMoney981, and Mike on Twitter at Borophils MTG. Did I get that right?
That is correct.
Nice. That's all from memory.
Yeah. Borophil. Sounds more like Borophil.
Anyway, and you can always catch Mike streaming. Not always, but he does that occasionally.
Yeah.
All of that stuff will be in the show notes. Friendly reminder, this podcast is, of course, brought to you by $100 Gaming Supplies of Hastings, Nebraska. Shop online or check them out if you're in town. Also, huge thanks to the Higher Standards folks just for being cool and screwing with me and offering me a box of Oath if something silly is printed in a standard set. I'll gladly take that wager.
You gotta give him credit for having the balls to do that, though.
Right, and I didn't even solicit it, so, I mean, I feel like if anything happens, I'm making out like a bandit.
Large
And everyone at the MTGcast Network who lets us host podcasts and do this kind of stuff, so do what you can to help them out, because they do it with no advertising and out of the kindness of their loving hearts. With that, we will see you next week with my wonderful two co-hosts. Midwest Magic is the only podcast that sometimes ends in witty retorts at the end. We'll see you next week.
I had to throw that in.